In the 1980s, Scott Ritter was a U.S. Marine. During the first Gulf War, he served as an advisor to General Norman Schwarzkopf. After the first Gulf War, he became the United Nations' top weapons inspector, spending 7 years going in and out of Iraq from 1991 to 1998, checking to see if and where Saddam Hussein had biological, chemical, nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Through those years, they found some things, destroyed some things, but towards the end of his time as a weapons inspector for the United Nations, he became convinced that there was no real threat there anymore, and he kept saying so for several years afterwards, including many times on this show in the build-up to the war with Iraq in 2003 and ever since. Now he has written about all of that in a brand new book called Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein. Scott, welcome back to the Paul Harris Show.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot for having me. I need to say one thing just to clarify right up front in case some people think I'm trying to rewrite history. When I resigned in 1998, I noted publicly that we had not completed our job in Iraq and that the mandate of the Security Council said it must be 100% compliance, that we could only give you about 90%, and that Iraq had the potential of still remaining a threat. And I was all in favor of having the inspectors stay in Iraq, get the full cooperation of the Iraqi government, and act without the interference of the U.S. government to complete their task. So I want to make sure people aren't thinking that I'm somehow reversing course on things that I said in 1998.
Okay, I'm glad you clarified that. And there were other people who took over the role of UN weapons inspector after you left and continued to do it, I guess, through 2002. But you always told me that you felt like that was not an independent investigation by that point.
No, by that time, the United States government, and this is one of the things I pointed out in my Senate testimony when I spoke out in defense of the inspection process. I said we had a job to do. We had not completed that job, and that using the Security Council's own words, as long as that job's not finished, Iraq poses a threat. That's why we sent weapons inspectors in there to begin with. But, to do the job, we have to focus on disarmament. And by this time, the United States had embraced a policy of regime change. They never were interested in disarmament. They used disarmament only as a vehicle to continue economic sanctions, and they used the disarmament process is a vehicle to spy on the security of Saddam Hussein in an effort to remove him from power. So the process was, by 1998, terminally corrupt.
All right. Now, that was during the years that Bill Clinton was president, before George Bush was elected in 2000. This was a time when you were saying, 90% sure that they don't have them and we have to keep going in there, but the administration was pretty sure that they were there, not only our administration, but also the government of Britain, and there were people in other countries, Israel at times, was saying that they were pretty sure that Saddam Hussein had them as well. How come all of these people, including the CIA, were so wrong?
Well, actually, one of the interesting things is that although these are statements, what you just said are things that are alluded to by many people, as the man who was responsible for coordinating intelligence with all of these governments, on behalf of the United Nations in 1998, I can tell you that none of them felt that way.
No, but they did later. I mean, Tony.
They did later, but that's an ideological shift. But in 1998, everybody recognized what the United Nations had accomplished. They just didn't want to go forward, especially the United States and Great Britain, and publicly acknowledge it. So they exaggerated intelligence. They downplayed our findings. They hyped up defective reports, all in an effort to maintain the public perception that Iraq was non-compliant, but they knew what the truth was.
You use words in the book like manipulating, suppressing, undermining. Was there anyone in the CIA or the White House or the Pentagon who supported you and fought for you?
I think that there were people, not in the White House. Look, the White House of Bill Clinton, may have started with good intention in 1993, but by 1996, 1997, 1998, they were trapped in a policy of regime change that made successful weapons inspections a threat to that policy, because if we succeed in disarming Iraq, economic sanctions would have to be lifted. So you had Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger, the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, literally conspiring to undermine the weapons inspection process. We did have people in the Pentagon who were providing us with technical assistance, and we had CIA analysts who were, and experts who were providing us with technical assistance, and they provided us with outstanding support. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, their managers, their bosses, were under orders from the Clinton administration not to allow Iraq to be found to be disarmed.
Now, when you said that word undermine, how exactly does that happen? I mean, here you are trying to do your job, and the people who followed you may have had a different mandate, but in the years that you were doing it, how did they undermine it? You say in the book that the CIA sabotaged your work and your information. Give me an idea of how that can happen.
I'll give you two specific examples. One is very precise. In October of 1992, I came back from a series of inspections that lasted over a course of several months, and I reported to the U.S. intelligence community that we had disarmed Iraq's ballistic missile program. There were no more missiles, and the missile installations had been destroyed or accounted for. They were monitored, and that we could close the book on the ballistic missile chapter. The U.S. intelligence community responded a week later with a four-page memorandum that said that they don't accept my findings. They believe that there's 200 missiles in Iraq and that we can't trust anything the Iraqis tell us, although they didn't provide any data on how they came up with the 200 number. This prompted a year-long investigation in which the CIA was finally prompted into providing the specifics of how they came up with the 200. They spoke of missiles buried in the desert, buried under rivers, etc. We did another inspection that, over the course of 2 months, took in ground-penetrating radar, searched for buried missiles, put divers in the rivers, and debunked all of the CIA's information. In November of 93, I met in the White House with senior members of the intelligence community, including the director of the CIA, James Woolsey. They were briefed again on our findings, how we debunked their 200-missile claim. I was invited to leave. Rolf Acacius, my boss, remained. James Woolsey told him that Mr. Ritter might be right. There aren't 200 missiles. The CIA's number is 12 to 20. And then he said that number will never change, regardless of what we do. That is sabotaging. That is undermining. That means the CIA will never allow the truth to be told. And then they control how we report future information. When you have an inspector on the ground who works for the CIA reporting to a chief inspector in Iraq who works for the CIA, who in turn reports back to a United Nations manager who works for the CIA, who reports to the deputy executive chairman, a senior American State Department official doing the CIA's bidding. Tell me who controls this process. It's not the United Nations. It's the CIA. They get to selectively pick and choose which information comes out of Iraq and is given a certain weight and which information is shunted aside.
So you're saying that they had an agenda and they were going to work towards that agenda regardless of what the facts are. You don't think it was a matter of them just being bad at their jobs?
No, they were actually very good at their job. Their job is set forth by the President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, in an October 1992 a lethal finding, said you are tasked with overthrowing Saddam Hussein using whatever means necessary, up to and including lethal force. Disarmament was only useful insofar as it facilitated this prime mission. If the weapons inspectors succeeded, they became a threat that had to be undermined, that had to be held back. The CIA was very good at what they do. I don't accept the notion of an intelligence failure. They succeeded in the job they were given, to get rid of Saddam Hussein. It was never about disarmament.
You went back to Iraq in the fall of 2002, and you've gotten quite a bit of criticism for doing so. That was a trip in which, as I understand it from the book, you tried to convince Saddam to allow the UN weapons inspectors back in as perhaps a way to avert the war that was coming in 2003. Did you actually meet with him face-to-face, or was it with his underlings?
No, I didn't meet with Saddam. He doesn't meet with former U.S. Marine officers who fought a war against him. It's not the best way for him to remain alive. They were very suspicious of my intent when I went over there. They didn't know quite what to make of it because I told them that I needed to address the Iraqi National Assembly. They could not have a text of my presentation. It had to be filmed before the live audience, an international audience. And then I wanted to meet with senior representatives. And I met with Tariq Aziz in South Africa, told him what I wanted to do. I said, if you don't do this, you're going to die. There's going to be a war. George Bush is running around the world telling everybody that listens that you have WMD. He says he won't let the inspectors back in, and right now nobody trusts you. If you don't let the inspectors back in, if you don't let them operate freely without precondition, public perception is that you have these weapons, you're a threat, and the world will support a war. I got to Iraq, I made my presentation, I met with the senior Iraqi officials, not Saddam, everybody but Saddam, and 5 days later, Saddam Hussein had a Council of Ministers meeting where all the people I met with prevailed upon him to allow the inspectors back in. I viewed it as a great victory. I gave peace a chance. And you know, the inspectors went in November of 2002. Prior to their going in, the U.S. intelligence community had talked about how the Iraqis had rebuilt their capability, how they were producing WMD. They even put out photographs of all the factories the Iraqis were doing this in. The new inspectors went in, went to every one of those factories, and said nothing's been going on here since 1991. No weapons are being built. They undermined the CIA's case, but unfortunately, nobody was listening.
By that point, you think it was too late? The war was going to happen regardless?
We know now that George Bush signed off on the military execute orders on August 28th. The U.S. Army has released that date in its chronology. That's when they received the order to invade Iraq. It means they have to start shipping their troops, line up their logistics, but from that moment on, it was an irreversible process.
When you were talking to the Iraqis, could you tell if they understood your message? Did they? Because it was obviously some sort of game going on here. It was kind of like a real-life version of the game Risk. You know, we're talking about a global battle here, and one guy doesn't want to let the other guy know what he thinks the other guy might know about him, and all that sort of, you know, double and triple layer stuff. Did they understand what you were telling them?
They most certainly did. Look, the Iraqis, and I'm not here to defend that regime, but, you know, in December of 1998, when weapons inspectors were ordered out of Iraq by Bill Clinton, and then a 72-hour bombing campaign was initiated, the first four cruise missiles fired by the United States into Iraq targeted Saddam Hussein, using intelligence information gathered by weapons inspectors. So they were very skeptical about the utility of inspections. They said, look, we know what the United States wants to do. They want to take us out. Why should we help them by allowing inspectors back in who last time were used to gather information about our national security? And I looked them in the eyes and I said, because if you don't, you're dead. I told this to Taha Yassin Ramadan. He met me in full military uniform with a well-used pistol on his hip in a holster. And when I told him that, I said, if you don't do this, I'm looking at a dead man. I thought the dead man I was looking at was my reflection in his eyes because he was not happy to hear what I was saying. I thought he was going to kick me out. He paused and he said, tell me again why you are here. And I went through the whole thing again. He asked some more questions and he said, when I meet with the president, I will pass on to him your message. I will prevail upon him to give it the seriousness that it deserves. So they understood exactly what I was telling to them, and they acted on it.
But they didn't understand it before you got there? They really didn't think that this was going to happen?
I think they honestly believed that the Russians and the French and the Chinese would not allow the United States to attack. They didn't think that the Security Council would permit it, and they didn't think the United States would go to war void of a Security Council resolution. What I told them is, by not allowing inspectors in, you make it impossible for the Russians and the French and the Chinese to stand up. But that if you allow the inspectors back in, if you give the inspectors the access, if you answer the questions, and you dissipate this fury, this furor going over regarding the speculation about the existence of WMD, you actually empower people to stand up and say war is not the solution. And so I think they finally registered.
What was the fallout here at home from your visit?
Oh, I was immediately called a traitor. I was accused of treason, of cavorting with the enemy. No one listened. I mean, the amazing thing is not only was my speech publicized, I mean, it was aired live, but when I came back, C-SPAN had me on and I read it live. No one listened to the words. What I said in that speech, there was nothing pro-Iraqi. I accused them of war crimes. I said, you have to let the international community come in and monitor your human rights. It's a disgrace. I said, you lied to the inspectors. You have a history of lying. You don't have democracy. You must work on this. But I also said the truth. I said, look, when it comes to weapons of mass destruction, you know, truth is on your side. Truth is your friend. Don't be afraid of the truth. Let the inspectors in. If you have no weapons, the inspectors will ascertain this, and they will tell the truth. I said, my government is on the verge of making a historical mistake. by going to war with you, it will not only destroy your country, but it will trap us in a war that we can't win. And by saying this, people said, oh, man, you're a traitor. They listened to only what they thought I was saying. They never listened to the totality of the statement.
Scott, do you think if you had been able to convince them of that and the war plan here had been put on pause, not canceled, but put on pause while those inspectors went back in there, that we could have trusted Saddam Hussein and his country to heed your words and really open up, and we really could have found out what the truth was as of late 2002?
Absolutely. First of all, they did just that. They did open up. The inspectors were allowed back in November 2002. They were given free access to every place they wanted to inspect. They went into Saddam Hussein's bedroom, for God's sake. I mean, anywhere they wanted to go, they got in. No delays, no headache. The big problem circled, centered around the issue of documents. The inspector said, look, we understand what you're saying. We have you on videotape. We have you recorded, etc. But we need documents. And the Iraqis kept saying there just simply aren't any documents. They were all destroyed, blown up in the bombing, or we've given you everything we have. And people just weren't willing to believe that. But at the end, it would have come down to these documents. And I don't think the world was ready to go to war with Iraq when the inspectors scour the country, find no weapons of mass destruction, and the only thing they need to confirm the statements made by the Iraqis are documents. The world's not going to go to war over those documents. You mitigate against any concerns a lack of documentation presents by implementing the most intrusive, technologically advanced on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control, and that's the other thing the inspectors were doing. They were monitoring the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure. They knew not only that Iraq did not retain WMD, but Iraq was not reconstituting WMD. Whether we could have trusted Saddam in the long run, we'll never have a chance to know. But I do know this, that would have been a much better option than the one we chose, and 2,000 Americans who have died in Iraq would be home with their parents today.
Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, the book is Iraq Confidential. We'll come back and talk more in just a moment as the Paul Harris Show continues here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. We're going to include your phone calls for Scott Ritter in just a moment at 314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. He is the U.S. Marine who served as the top weapons inspector from 1991 to 1998 in Iraq. He writes about that and what happened between his leaving Iraq and the beginning of the war in 2003 and the aftermath as well in his new book called Iraq Confidential. One of the things you talk about in the book, Scott, is a coup attempt in June of 1996. Many people through the years have asked, why didn't the CIA just go in there and have some sort of secret behind-the-scenes mission to get Saddam? Tell me about this coup that you know about from 1996.
Well, first of all, the CIA did have the mission. It was given to them in October of 1992 by then-President George Herbert Walker Bush in the form of a lethal finding that said the CIA's primary mission regarding Iraq is regime change, and they were tasked with overthrowing Saddam Hussein using any means necessary, including lethal force. By 1993, the CIA was working with a man who many people might recognize, named Ahmed Chalabi, in the Iraqi National Congress in northern Iraq, trying to orchestrate a coup d'etat. They were not successful. By 1995, Saddam's continued survival was posing a political embarrassment to Bill Clinton, who was getting ready to run for re-election in 96, and he ordered the CIA to redouble its efforts to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and said that Saddam must be removed by June 1996 so that they could focus in the summer of 96 on this re-election free of the specter of Saddam Hussein. The CIA turned to an organization called the Iraqi National Accord, another name that might be familiar to Americans, Iyad Alawi. We might recognize him as being the interim prime minister for the Iraqi government prior to the January elections this year. Before he was an Iraqi politician, however, he was a paid agent of the CIA. And his job was to facilitate a coup d'etat. He and his group had infiltrated a specific unit of the Special Republican Guard, Saddam Hussein's bodyguard unit, the 3rd Battalion. And they recruited officers who said that they are ready to move on Saddam if the other Special Republican Guard units surrounding Saddam could be eliminated. So in walks the United Nations. In 1995, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamal, defects. He tells us not only that all weapons are destroyed, but he says that in 1991, certain things were hidden, including documents and material that are still being hidden, and they were hidden by elements of the Special Republican Guard. and that we would need to investigate these. So we did start investigating them. The CIA took advantage of our interest in the Special Republican Guard to help focus an inspection timed, coincidentally enough, for June 1996. We were inspecting all Special Republican Guard units in the greater Baghdad area except the 3rd Battalion. I said, we need to inspect it. The CIA turned to me and said, don't worry about those guys. We know all about them. They're doing nothing of interest. We'll leave them alone. Well, we went, we inspected, the Iraqis blocked us, we were withdrawn. The anticipation was that the United States would bomb every single one of the Special Republican Guard units that we had been blocked in front of, suppressing Saddam's protection, allowing the 3rd Battalion to move in and assassinate him. Unfortunately for the CIA, Saddam's security forces had infiltrated the coup, fully aware of what was going on, and they rounded up the coup plotters and executed them. There was no coup, but the other thing that Iraqis were able to uncover was the link between the CIA and the UN weapons inspectors. And from that point on, every time we went into Iraq, the Iraqis didn't see us as people trying to disarm them. They viewed us as people trying to kill their president. And sadly speaking, they were right.
And that's one of the ways you say that you were undermined in your efforts.
Well, it terminally corrupted the integrity of the operation. We're supposed to be there to disarm Iraq, and yet we were being used unwittingly, but we were still being used as a vehicle to achieve regime change. So, people ask today, why did the Iraqis block you? I mean, if they didn't have any weapons, the CIA acknowledges now that all weapons were destroyed in 1991. If the Iraqis didn't have any weapons, why didn't they cooperate? Well, they did cooperate when we focused on disarmament. However, whenever we got involved in something that touched upon the security of Iraq, they would block us, not because they were hiding weapons of mass destruction, but because they had legitimate concerns that our inspections were being used by the CIA to target their president.
314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. Marcus, you're on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX with Scott Ritter. Hello.
Hi, Scott. First of all, thank you for serving. I got two questions here. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, were some of the terms of surrender that there was weapons inspections to be done? Yes or no on that?
Well, no, there were no terms of surrender. There was a ceasefire resolution, and then following that, there was an additional resolution that said that weapons inspectors would be allowed back in, and if the Iraqis refused to cooperate with the inspectors, then the ceasefire resolution would be considered null and void.
Okay. Now, how many times were you guys kicked out of Iraq from the Iraqi government?
None. When we left in December 1998, we weren't kicked out by the Iraqi government. We were actually ordered out by the Clinton administration, who had deliberately set up a confrontation with the Iraqi government. But the Iraqi government did not kick the inspectors out of Iraq.
All right, okay. There you go. Thanks for calling, Marcus. Paul, you're on KMOX. Hello.
How you doing, Paul?
Good.
I would just like to know how Scott sleeps at night telling all these lies. In 1993, he gassed 20,000 Kurds with weapons of mass destruction. And he just said in 91 he got rid of his weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I think
how do you sleep with yourself?
I think you need to check your chronology.
Paul, let him answer your question. Hold on. Both of you, you can't both talk at the same time. And, Paul, you asked a question, and you attacked the man. Let him defend himself.
Well, I think before he puts allegations out there, he should check his chronology. I believe the date he's referring to is 1986, not 1993. I think the event is the gassing of Kurds in Halabja. Not 20,000, but 5,000. That's far too many. And the United States government was fully aware of this. There were no UN weapons inspectors back then. The U.S. government failed to condemn that act. However, recognizing that Saddam Hussein had behaved irresponsibly in 1991, the international community said that Iraq must be rid of its chemical weapons. And by 1993, sir, the date you accused me of somehow collaborating with the Iraqi government to gas the Kurds, we had destroyed their chemical weapons, thereby safeguarding the future of the very Kurds you're concerned about.
Scott, you mentioned Ahmad Chalabi before. Here's a guy who was a trusted source, then a distrusted source. Now he's one of the top guys in Iraq. He's one of the higher-ups in the new Iraqi government. He got a puff piece with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago that you probably saw. What does his role mean for Iraq in the future and our role with Iraq?
Well, Ahmad Chalabi has not been an honest player from day one. Now, he's somebody who left Iraq back in the, almost 30 years ago, has no constituency inside Iraq. There were charges that he embezzled money in Jordan. He had to leave that country under a cloud. He denies it. He worked with the CIA in 1993. He thought that the CIA would somehow install him as the president of Iraq, but he was unable to get a coalition together to back him. He embezzled money from the CIA, so fell into disfavor with the CIA. But then, when the neocons back in the late 1990s needed an excuse to go into Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi was only too willing to provide so-called defectors. I mean, he was amazing. He could produce more defectors with access to top secret information in Iraq than anybody could. And even though, for instance, we investigated these defectors, I met with Ahmad Chalabi on a number of occasions, and we went over these sources. We investigated these sources and found them to be fraudulent, baseless. But the neocons and anybody who was advocating war found Ahmad Chalabi's sources too good to be true, and they readily published it. Judith Miller used Ahmad Chalabi as one of her primary sources for a series of articles she wrote about the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But perhaps more disturbing than the lies he told to get us to war is who Ahmad Chalabi really works for. Today in Iraq, the government is pretty much a government controlled by the Iranians, and Ahmad Chalabi has emerged as a close ally of the theocracy in Tehran, and yet, as you said, he's positioning himself to be a major player, for the future of Iraq. This is not good for Iraq. This is not good for the United States, and ultimately, it won't be good for Iran either, because it's only going to drive them further down the path of confrontation with the United States.
Yeah, I've always thought this guy was a weasel and couldn't be trusted, and always thought he was the architect of everything that has happened there for years and years now. We go back to the phones. Paul, you're on KMOX with Scott Ritter. Hello.
Hey, Scott, good conversation. Hey, I got a question that's always bothering me about these so-called weapons of mass destruction and why they didn't find them. It's been my understanding that with a biological weapon, since a biological weapon is an organism, you really don't make it and then store it, because the organism will die. You simply make it to use it, and the same when you need it, and the same with the chemical weapons. The major problem with storing a lot of chemical weapons, if the users happen to have a leak, it destroys them. It's too big of a risk, so they literally make these weapons when they plan to use them. So therefore, since they didn't store them, they really had access to making this, the technology to make this stuff, but they really didn't store them anywhere because of the danger of the storage problem.
Did they have the capability of making these things, Scott?
Well, they made the weapons, there's no doubt about it, but the caller is absolutely correct that the stability of chemical weapons and the long-term viability of biological weapons, there's a short shelf life, and some of the chemical agent, especially the nerve agent, you could measure it in days. The Iraqis during the Iran-Iraq War literally had to pump it out of the factory, put it in an artillery shell, and send it straight to the front line to be shot, or otherwise it became useless goop. So the Iraqis never mastered the ability to stabilize nerve agent or make, for instance, dry powdered anthrax. Dry powdered anthrax could be stored for a long time if it was done in the right conditions, but the Iraqis only made a liquid bulk agent, and it had a shelf life of 3 years max under ideal storage conditions. So, a lot of people are saying, hey, they could have hidden this stuff, The fact is, even if they had hidden it, and we have no evidence that they did, it would have been useless goop within a period of months or years at the most.
All right, Paul, thank you for calling. Scott, when you were writing this book, and I know you've been working on it for quite a while, you had to talk to a lot of people in the U.S. government. Did you have trouble getting them to come forward and tell you what they knew?
Nah, I mean, there's people who are inclined to talk, and there's people who are inclined not to talk. First of all, I didn't have to go to that many people, because the book is primarily based on my firsthand experience. I did talk to people just to say, hey, I remember this event this way, or in my notes I say this, what do you remember? And a lot of people would help me make sure that I got the record absolutely correct, because in a book of this nature, if I'm wrong about anything, they're going to come down and they're going to expose it. So, it has to be 100% correct. So I did go to people, not for new information, because the book is my story, not anybody else's story, but for, just confirmation. I did, however, interview a number of Iraqis, especially intelligence officers, who were responsible for, watching the United Nations inspectors while I was there. These were the guys who, this is like spy versus spy. These were the guys who were spying on us, and they gave me tremendous insight into, what the Iraqis were doing, what they were up to, how they felt about the inspections, what their true intent was, and on the one hand, it was frightening because what I found is that the Iraqis had succeeded in pretty much infiltrating the inspections at almost every level. They had great insight into what we were planning to do. And that might make you think that, wow, they could have hidden the weapons. But then you ask them, why did they do that? And they said, not because we're hiding weapons, but because we thought you were trying to kill our president. So we needed to make sure that when you sent an inspection team in, we had a good idea of what it is you were really trying to accomplish.
What are you doing for a living these days, Scott?
I'm a writer, I'm a speaker, and I'm a firefighter.
A firefighter. Oh, good. Good for you. The book is called Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein, former UN weapons inspector. And I once introduced him as former Marine. He corrected me and said, no, no such thing. So, U.S. Marine, Scott Ritter, thanks for your time, as always. A pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks a lot, sir.
Scott Ritter here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.